Okay, good morning, everybody. Today is February 9th, 2017, and this is the monthly meeting of the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. I'm Robert Spagnoletti, Chair of the Board, and with me today are all of our board members, so we have a full quorum here today. We are meeting in room 540 South at 1 Judiciary Square, which is our regular board meeting room. An agenda was posted in accordance with the Open Meetings Act for today's meeting, and unless there are any amendments, deletions, changes, we'll go ahead and adopt it.
I have a couple of amendments.
Okay.
For item number A, I failed to include budget with the performance hearing and budget.
Okay.
And then I have an additional item, which would be item F, just the general category of legislation.
Okay. With those amendments, should we go ahead and adopt the agenda? All right. Any objections? No? Okay. By consensus, we'll go ahead and do that. So let's go ahead and move to the report of the Director of Open Government, Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The BGUP budget review team meeting with the mayor's staff was held on January 6th. The Office of Open Government has requested a $35,000 enhancement to the fiscal year 2018 budget to cover operational expenses. The OOG has been asked to take over from the ethics side, and personnel services funding in the amount of $20,000 to cover the salary increase for the one legal service FTE under our office. Without the enhancement, the Office of Open Government will have just $7,781 for the entire fiscal year 2018.
Right.
The enhancement request will be provided as part of the pre-hearing responses BGA has been asked to submit to Chairman Allen in preparation for the February 23rd, 2017 BGA performance hearing. MACA, the enforcement action against the Mayor's Advisory Commission on Caribbean Community Affairs is ongoing. Mr. Barton is going to provide the members of the board with an update on that action.
Okay.
As the board is well aware, the OG is in litigation with Michael Yates, chairman of the Mayor's Advisory Commission on Caribbean Community Affairs, for committing over 25 violations of the OMA. These violations include meeting in improper closed sessions, the failure to timely post agendas and meeting minutes, and the failure to record by electronic means numerous meetings. In response to defendants Yates' motion to dismiss the OOG's amended complaint or in the alternative for summary judgment, the OOG filed on February 7, 2017, opposition to the defendant's motion to dismiss and a cross motion for summary judgment. By consent motion, the parties are requesting a continuance of the February 10, 2017 initial scheduling conference until March 24. The continuance will serve the purpose of avoiding what may be an unnecessary conference or being put on a discovery track and having discovery start before the court is able to rule on the pending motions, which could potentially dispose of the case and grant the relief the OOG is seeking.
Okay. And remind me, who's this in front of?
Judge Campbell.
Oh, John Campbell? Okay. All right. Thank you for that. And to be clear, you're represented by outside counsel.
We're represented by outside counsel. I am now out of it. I'm a witness in the case. Mr. Barton and the outside counsel have been working together. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. The Office of Open Government is continuing to receive complaints about DCRA's failure to abide by the direction given in the January 2016 opinion issued by the OOG, finding DCRA is in violation of DC Code 2-536 by not making available on its website all pending permits, authorized permits, and permit files. DCRA is now taking the position that there is nothing in the statute requiring the agency to make the records available free of charge, despite the provision that 2-536 records are to be mandatorily supplied online. So I have been requested by a couple of members of the public to testify at the upcoming DCRA performance hearing in March. I have declined to testify as the opinion still speaks for itself and it's still applicable. But I encourage members of the public, if they want to continue to cite to the opinion, they can continue to do so.
Right.
But if any of the council members ask me to attend to answer questions, I will do that.
This is a bit of a change in position from DCRA, is it not? I mean, I recall last year their position was we know we have to do this, but we have these technological issues. Some of these, you know, the the blueprints are big, and we don't, I mean, I remember the whole back and forth, but there were, I don't recall them making the argument that they did not need to make it available free of charge. Rather, that was a capacity issue. So now they've
shifted. This is new. This is a shift.
I'm just making sure it's not me that's changing.
No, this is a shift. It is a rather unique argument, one that I do not agree with. I don't think that that is the proper interpretation of 2-536, given the fact that if things are available online,
by definition,
it follows that it's free. However, I've not been asked to formally weigh in on that position. This is just something that's been conveyed to me by members of the public.
Okay.
Since the last board meeting, the Office of Open Government has responded to 22 requests for FOIA advice and 9 requests for Open Meetings Act advice. The OOG has issued one opinion addressing whether the Department of Behavioral Health Ombudsman Advisory Council is a public body under the Open Meetings Act, and that opinion is on the Office of Open Government website.
Okay.
Trainings. We conducted 3 trainings in the last month. The OOG and OGE, the Office of Government Ethics, conducted a combined Open Meetings Act and ethics training for the members of the Commission on Arts and Humanities, which I'm sorry I missed because I understand it was quite lively. Janet and Mr. Barton conducted that training. We conducted an OMA training for the newest members of the Concealed Pistol Licensing Review Board and a FOIA training for the United Medical Center. We do intend to go back at a later date to the United Medical Center to train additional personnel on just the basics of FOIA rather than the full FOIA training. On January 6th, Director Sobin and I had a conference call with Betsy Cavendish, the Mayor's General Counsel, and Stephen Walker, the Director of MOTA, to be briefed on the feedback they are getting about the trainings that we conduct. On the open government side, there was discussion about making the training shorter for public body members and doing a more detailed training for the administrative points of contact. As for the former, I had to push back a bit because the Open Meetings Act training that we currently conduct is a condensed training but reviews every aspect of the Open Meetings Act public body members are required to know. The OMA is clear in this regard that all public body members must be trained on the requirements of the Open Meetings Act. The additional factor to consider is that if there are additional enforcement actions that must be brought by the Office of Open Government does not want to provide an opening for public body members to claim that they were not fully trained on the Open Meetings Act.
How long is the training?
We've gotten it down to probably about an hour and a half, and that's with both of us, so 45 minutes each, and that's with questions. Sometimes it can be an hour, depending on how sleepy people are. But the training is pretty condensed and concise. Regarding the points of contact training, we will revise the training to include greater detail about posting to the central calendar. And right before I came in, MOTA reached out asking about some additional dates that we have available in February and March to do that point of contact training. Development and tracking tools. Just as we've done with the central calendar, the Office of Open Government is making an additional resource available to the public that will promote greater transparency and allow us internally to more effectively track our advice giving. Wada Kitab has been working for several months on the OOG dashboard that will be a public-facing dashboard and will be entirely web-based. It's a compilation of 4 different coding languages, and OOG will be able to maintain it internally without Octo support at a minimal cost of what we're anticipating to be about $2,000 a year. So I've asked Wada to pull it up for you all so you can see what it's going to look like. And I've asked him to just generally explain the template that you see here.
Wada, can you increase that by chance?
You mean the screen size?
Yeah. Because the conference call boxes are in the way.
While he's getting that together, I'll just move on to the last point. Legislation. The Office of Open Government worked with Councilmember Bond's office regarding the Advisory Neighborhood Commission's Omnibus Amendment Act of 2016. Bob, you may recall, and for the other board members, there has been ongoing discussion regarding ANC compliance with ANC's own open records requirements. ANCs do not fall under the requirements of the OMA. However, they are required to abide by Section 1-309. 1-309, in many respects, is mirrored in the Open Meetings Act. But, of course, with ANCs, some people are more cognizant of complying with the law versus others. So the Office of Open Government recommended and offered about a year ago to duplicate our central calendar for use by ANCs. That was something that was declined in this bill. There will be something similar offered but created by OCTO and maintained on the executive side to include ANC meetings, their contact information, media meeting agendas, records, etc. Right. However, it came to light that because many ANCs were receiving FOIA requests, all things considered, much less than what agencies receive, ANCs were receiving inaccurate information concerning the compliance requirements with the Freedom of Information Act. So what this bill would do, and it's still, as I understand, awaiting the mayor's signature, would then formally insert the Office of Open Government and require this office to conduct FOIA training for all ANCs. Okay.
Yeah, this is going to be an active year for ANCs all the way around, because we, on the ethics side, we have also some clarification about various issues involving them as well. So it looks like everyone's going to be focused on ANCs.
Yes. So here is the online database, and this is what the public dashboard will look like. The goal of this is to completely inform and fully inform the public on the number of requests that the office is fielding, the types of requests that it is fielding, and the request breakdowns would, of course, be for FOIA compliance, Open Meetings Act compliance, and then we also receive numerous requests for technical compliance, i.e., how do we get into the central calendar? Oh. We also receive numerous requests that are entirely related to the FOIA portal, mm-hmm. with members of the public calling to check in on the status of their FOIA requests. It will also include tracking of...
So they're calling you as opposed to the agency they actually requested the documents from?
Yes. It will also track the FOIA requests by calendar and fiscal year. And then, of course, you see just the visual displays of the pie chart of Open Meetings Act compliance. Of course, we can't include FOIA in this compliance audit because we don't have authority to compel agencies to provide records.
Right.
The bottom portion of this will be for internal facing purposes only for Mr. Barton, Mr. Katab, and I, so we can keep track of the types of advice in terms of subject matter that we are providing to members of the public and then also to agencies. It will also include, for the public portion, a breakdown of the number of requests we're receiving from the government versus the number of requests for advice we're receiving from the public.
Got it.
Okay. Are there any questions?
Right, no, looks great.
I do. If you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back a little bit to the discussion of consumer, and regulatory affairs office. This is sort of an ongoing thing, because I was here when we talked about it last year. Do we have a strategy of how we're going to deal with this? Because I can understand, and I was here for that huge, the discussion of gigantic displays and all that. Those obviously could not be available for free. I mean, that would cost the government a fortune to do that. I can understand. But if things need to be available, I mean, that you can take pictures of large displays and put them on a portal. I mean, put them on the website. And if people then I could see wanted a copy of that, I could see charging some amount, not a huge amount, because I think we found out that I remember our discussion in the past felt like that there may be the companies that were doing the copying of these kinds of things were getting paid pretty nicely. And therefore, since they were doing a government function, that maybe our residents or people that were dealing with the government were thinking that they were being charged too high an amount. And I think we sort of felt that way at the time as well. My question is, I understand some of the arguments, so therefore I think there could be some charge as long as it wasn't a profit-making charge to a private company. But I just wanted to know if there was any strategy and what are we going to do about here we are now this long time later, and there doesn't seem to be a change and just a different argument. Why not?
Well, the immediate answer is that my hands are still tied because the Office of Open Government, because it has no authority to compel agencies to provide records, nor do I have the ability to require DCRA to abide by the findings in the opinion, although they have acknowledged that they're not in compliance. So until such time that I am given a path and a roadway, either by the executive or the council, to take a more formal position and a more formal stance and interject the office in a more detailed way, there isn't much that I can do.
Okay, and that's why.
Now, regarding the electronic records, what is particularly vexing and troubling about this issue is since 2015, DCRA has been accepting all of these permit applications and all of the relevant documents electronically. So they have them electronically. The question is, why are they unable to provide them to the public in that same format? That is a question that still has not been answered, other than just simply generally by DCRA to say that they're revamping their IT infrastructure. But again, I don't have the authority to go in and ask those probing, detailed questions. I have to rely on members of the council who've taken this up as their particular charge to ask those questions and then come back to me for feedback if they would like to. Now, in terms of the vendors, DCRA has increased that list. The last list I saw was to 6. So people are being shuffled to 6 different vendors now versus 1. They are still being asked to pay for those copy costs. My position there is until we know the details as to why technically DCRA is unable to do this. I propose, well, if DCRA knows this is a problem, why not build this into their fiscal year 18 budget where they can cover the costs or have members of the public, they go and they get these copies, but then they're reimbursed by the agency. I don't know if that will fly or not. I don't know how crazy of an idea that is, but there seems to me there needs to be some relief for members of the public. Now, I have always maintained that there's more here than meets the eye. No one yet has been willing to follow the money. I have always maintained that this is something that needs to be reviewed by another agency, either by the auditor or the inspector general, because there has to be a connection between DCRA and why Blue Boy was originally chosen to do this. But again, I don't have the authority to ask those questions.
All right. Well, I appreciate the more additional discussion of this, Mr. Chairman. And we might, even though we may not have total authority, since it is public information that is in question here, we may sometime, even if we don't have exact authority, maybe do a recommendation, just a helpful, constructive recommendation for future action or something. I mean, I just suggest that as maybe something we'll think about futuristically.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything else?
No. Okay. That concludes my update.
Great. All right. We'll get a report from the Director of Government Ethics, Mr. Sobin.
Turn on my mic here. Thank you for coming today. We have some things to go over, but nothing too complicated. Try and finish up as expeditiously as possible. And the first item on our list is the update on our operations and our statistics. Investigations opened. We did 3 currently. Last month we opened up 1. That compares to 1 opened up in November. So we're starting to have the uptick again from our low back in November. Investigations closed was 4. Last month that had been 5, as opposed to our biggest month, which was in November, which was 10. And that's why it gives us our current low, sort of low end of currently open investigations at 6. Last month it was 5. And our state investigations are consistent at about 22. Now, as I've said, for the last couple of months, we're about to take a huge hit from the Inspector General's office on cases coming in. So that number six is probably going to go, probably going to switch with the investigation stayed, and go to about 20, where the investigation stayed are going to be about six, because they're all going to come over at the same time. So we're gearing up for that. Publication and reporting requirements, our publication and reporting obligations, we are in compliance. We recently completed updating information for our fiscal year 17 and fiscal year 18 performance plans for the mayor. And not too much has changed from last year. Our performance standards are about the same. They're going to be tracking the number of the time it takes us to do our investigations, which internally is set at 120 days. How quickly we turn our request for formal opinions around at 30 days, and then how quickly you guys get an opinion out in a contested case, if there is a contested case. We've got a bunch of new initiatives in there. If anybody wants to check it out, it's on the mayor's performance plan website. You can look at the specifics on what we plan to hold ourselves to in the upcoming fiscal years. Trainings and outreach. Several staff attended a 2.5-hour website training on how to add content to the BEGA website once the website is transferred back to us and hosted by Okto. The idea is that we'll be able to upload content ourselves, and where necessary, Okto will provide IT assistance. Trainings conducted by staff was 9, which is slightly up from the 8 we did last month. The 9 trainings include 2 new employee orientations, 2 MSS trainings, 1 general board and commission training, an abbreviated training session for the Department of Energy and the Environment, and trainings at the Office of the Attorney General for its incoming class of Chuck Ruff Fellows. And we did one for boards and commission members, the board members of the Commission on Arts and Humanities. Excuse me. Item D, opinions and advice. In formal advice, we gave out advice in 61 cases since the last meeting, up from 32 last month. Additionally, we responded to more than 24 queries related to lobbyist registration and lobbyist activity reporting. This last period, of course, fell during the registration activity reporting period. On January 23rd, we finalized for publication a sua sponte advisory opinion on social media. You guys have all seen it. You weighed in on it. We received only one comment from the council, and it was actually a good one, and we incorporated it into the final version. So that opinion is now is it published for final already? Is it made it out there?
It is for publication.
It is published? Okay. So it is published. It is final now. Excuse me. Ethics legislation and the Comprehensive Code of Conduct. Since the last board meeting, at least one ethics-related bill, actually two now, right, Mr. Grimaldi?
Right.
Have been introduced in the council. Mr. Grimaldi circulated to you a copy of Councilmember Nadeau's bill, 22-0036, the Ethics Reform Amendment Act of 2017, which is substantively the same as her earlier bill that lapsed at the end of council period 21. The bill contains several recommendations the board made in the 2014 best practices report, and it's also encouraging to note that Councilmember Allen, our new oversight committee chair, is among the co-introducers. A number of other bills are in the works, including, of course, our own bill to establish the Comprehensive Code of Conduct. I'll hand it over to Mr. Grimaldi to update you on that front since he's taken the lead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Sobin. The second bill that's actually been filed since the last board meeting is Bill 22-0038, short title, Lobbyist Activity Reporting Transparency Amendment Act of 2017. And the bottom line intent behind the legislation, which was introduced by, again, our oversight chair, Allen, Silverman, Che, and Grasso. So require lobbyists to file monthly activity reports. Should I repeat that?
No, I heard you. Monthly activity reports.
Okay. So before it was actually introduced, Kate Mitchell reached out to Darren and had a heart-to-heart.
I'm sure that's the case.
About the potential fiscal impact of this, well aware of Darren's concerns, which Kate did
noted them.
Right. So the bottom line was what they're looking to do with this particular piece of legislation, and we'll be talking about another in the closed session, is to start a more general conversation about lobbyist registration.
Sure.
Okay. So it's sort of let's open the door. They're looking perhaps to a round table down the line, and we've certainly offered to be part of that.
But yeah. And I'm sure Mr. Sobin made this point very clear, but it's one thing to say file monthly. It's another thing to actually go through the process and then enforce it and then review it and then audit it and then do all the things that come along with it. And as you know, you spend, and then consequently we spend a phenomenal amount of time, dealing with everything from waiver requests to late fees to this to that. And so a monthly report, again, there may be benefits to that that justify the huge expense that's going to come along with it. But I will say, and I know we have two of them today, two audits that Ms. Alumni has done, that demonstrate, again, for the umpteenth time, that generally speaking, yeah, there's money, maybe a glitch here or there, but people generally register and they generally report their activities, and now we're doing it every 6 months. So I would just put that out there to say, is there a problem? This is a situation where we have a solution in need of a problem as they think about what they're doing and why they're doing it. Because so far, at least, based on what we have seen, things, at least on the registration side and the reporting side, generally speaking, seem to be working as originally intended.
We'll get to another bill in just a minute that has a financial impact, but just to sort of put it out there, that monthly filing and what the financial impact would be, just to have 13 council members file their financial disclosure statements twice a year instead of once a year, the financial impact has been determined to be $94,000 the first year and then $45,000 more for us every year after this. So it's going to be astronomical.
Right. No, this stuff matters. It's not simply, fill out another form and stick it online. That's not the reality of the way this stuff plays out. So we're very mindful of that. But I, who knows where this is all going to go. But I would just say, because I know that, again, we have two of them today that we're going to be talking about briefly, and it shows, again, that things seem to be working in all respects the way they were originally intended to work. And so, therefore, one wonders whether or not the benefit and the cost of a monthly reporting, whether there's any benefit that justifies what is going to be an extreme cost and investment in manpower. But that being said, it's not for us to decide.
Yeah.
Simply to comment on.
A couple of other things. Just to double back on Nadeau's reintroduced bill, Kate Mitchell also said that she's put Councilmember Nadeau's staff on notice that any of the provisions in that bill would be folded into the CCC.
CCC, oh, great.
Okay, so that they're aware of that track.
Awesome.
Okay. And getting the impression that between campaign finance reform legislation, more direct ethics-related stuff, Council Period 22 is off to a roaring start.
Mm-hmm.
Two other pieces of legislation, one of which I did circulate to the board, I think, late last week. It's a draft bill at this point. It's called the Bega Amendment Act of 2017. First of all, I want to thank our two directors for their assisting me over a period of time with very thoughtful comments about the legislation. A quick backdrop to the purpose of the bill, or the purpose behind the bill, is by way of a quick history. When the board was established back in 2012, the Office of Open Government had already been established a couple of years before, and just I found in the committee report of the Ethics Act a very brief background, which I'll just read to you. Established in late 2010 by the Open Meetings Amendment Act of 2010, the Open Government Office was charged with administering and enforcing the district's new and enhanced open meetings and FOIA laws. In fact, the OGO, as called in the committee report, was funded in the fiscal year 2012 budget at approximately $350,000. However, the executive has not yet appointed a director to oversee the operations of the office, and thus the public disclosure and access remains lacking. And again, this committee report was in December of 2011, so that's the time frame. The committee believes that the functioning of this office is critical to maintaining the public's trust in its government, and thus it's appropriate for inclusion within the new Board of Ethics. As such, the bill would provide for the Board of Ethics to appoint a director. The remainder of the Open Meetings Act would not be altered. Simply put, the OGO would be stood up within the new board, and the OGO's duties, employees, assets, and any unspent funds would be transferred to the new board. So that's the short and sweet history of how, as we now have come to know it and love it, OOG and OGE were kind of joined at the hip, okay? Now that we've had several years of operating experience, a few issues have arisen. And one of them, reflected in the bill there, is that for administrative convenience only, we've been referring to this Office of Government Ethics. But there has never been any formal establishment of that office. So the bill would accomplish that purpose. Budget stuff. We've got two offices within the same or under the same umbrella that potentially have jurisdiction over the other, yet as the law currently stands, the director of the Office of Government Ethics is basically responsible for the budget. So that kind of a sticky wicket. And this legislation would put the primary responsibility for submitting the budget to the mayor as part of the overall budget to the board. And what the board would be able to do by the terms of the legislation here is direct the respective directors to submit budgets for their own agencies to then just be put together, and then the board would put the overall budget forward. There are a few other technical amendments to the Open Meetings Act, and Tracy, if you want to add, you know, some why you wanted some of those things, I'll let you speak to that. And then the last thing I just wanted to mention, in terms of a sea change, if you will, as you all know, one of the responsibilities of this board is simply to appoint the director of the Office of Open Government. This legislation would change that and have the director of that office serve at the pleasure of the board, as does the director of the Office of Government Ethics.
And I'll just say that one of the reasons that that's important, we've had these discussions with Ms. Hughes, is that at the moment she lives in this bifurcated existence where the personnel authority sits outside of the board. And so although we hired her and set her initial salary, just functionally speaking, any changes to that, any salary increase, anything, while we can certainly voice our views of the whole thing, but we don't actually control it. No performance, you know, the performance basis for raising salaries and the rest, we don't have the authority to do it. We would once the legislation gets passed. And therefore, the director of open government would no longer live in a bifurcated existence where she's got to make a case to someone wholly unrelated and not necessarily in the weeds of what we do about why her salary should be X, Y, or Z and the associated personnel issues that come along with it. So this is the fix. Interestingly enough, I will tell you that in the meeting I had with the mayor is and her general counsel have signed off on all of this. And when I was meeting with her to discuss it, she was frankly surprised that it wasn't this way from the beginning of the movement of OOG over from Office of Campaign Finance to the board. That is, I think she personally was unaware of the fact that you said sort of the split existence, if you will. So she was happy to put her stamp on fixing the problem. So,
right.
But the other thing also is just to echo what Mr. Grimaldi said is that this bifurcated budget problem will, well, we will bifurcate the budget, but it, at the moment, because all the money resides over here, puts Ms. Hughes in a very uncomfortable position of having to go to Mr. Sobin, everything from timekeeping to, you know, buying stuff to everything else, which, again, given, as Jack said, two offices that have authority over each other for their respective roles, and they're, that operate independently of each other, they shouldn't be, she should not be forced to have to go to Mr. Sobin for those issues by operation of the statute. So this way, we get the budget, us, but the actual mechanics of the operation of the budget go to each of the respective offices. And that allows us also to advocate independently. We're not arguing for one. It's not a zero. You get more here, they get less there. You get more there, you get less there. Now we have two distinct entities that we have oversight of, but that can... They can advocate individually and on behalf of themselves as opposed to trying to do a tug of war between the joint budget. It's fixing a long-standing organizational problem that will hopefully make both sides run a lot more smoothly.
Right. Did you want to speak to the more technical aspects? The
no, because I don't have the technical amendments in front of me.
Establish that fund and it's
thank you for the reminder. So one of the huge things that's going to be before us, assuming that we're going to be successful in this enforcement action, is if the court agrees to award fines in this instance, where do the fines go? Currently, the Office of Government Ethics has an O-type fund where it can only use those fines for particular purposes, i.e. lobbyist purposes, for example. But for the Office of Open Government, we have no such bucket. So this bill will also include an O-type fund for the Office of Open Government, in addition to other minor technical amendments that Mr. Barton picked up in the original enactment.
And just to follow up on that, because you see the logic, the logical problem with the fine issue the way it sits now. So OOG enforces against one of the public bodies, you know, District of Columbia entity, whatever violation occurs. And I know it's still kind of an open question about who's paying the fine, but let's assume it's the entity that pays the fine out of the district's budget, which then goes right back into the district's budget.
The general fund.
So there's very little financial incentive through the fine process, which is really all that Ms. Hughes has available to her. There's very little incentive built in right now for the district government writ large to comply, because what they're going to do is move the money from here right back to here, as opposed to an O-type fund. And again, these are not gigantic amounts of money, so we're not depriving the general fund of major operating costs here, but enough just to say...
It's depriving me of major operational costs.
Well, yeah, but that's... The thing is, if you have $7,000 for next year, the way it currently stands for, you know, non-personal service stuff, I mean, the fact that you had an additional $3,000 or $4,000 or whatever it could be given the course of a year, that's significant. So it's just, again, it's another logical fix now that we've had years of experience in doing this and your first enforcement action. So
before... turn it over to the board for discussion questions. The only is sort of strategy, in a word. This bill in draft form was circulated back in the fall. There was some thought at that point, well, we'll introduce it as a freestanding piece. But then we realized, well, the council period is going to end at the end of December. It'll probably lapse.
Right.
Oh, let's fold it into the CCC. That's going forward. And that didn't happen. That lapsed. So now we're thinking, because of some of the issues that we've discussed this morning, the most expedient vehicle for getting this done is to fold the substantive provisions of this bill into the BSA.
Which is the Budget Support Act. And for those of you who may not be fully familiar with it, this is the piece of legislation that accompanies the budget that sort of puts in place the many different – it's a gigantic piece of legislation – but it puts in place all the mechanical, technical things to implement the budget and some new policies and programs and the rest that get funded through the new budget. And this would be, you know, a blip. I mean, literally, because the book is this thick, but a tiny little blip of the BSA as a whole. But it would, it's the most expedient way, and we've gotten word from
EOM.
From EOM that they can do it. So, yeah.
And a fallback is if EOM, for whatever reason, won't do it or can't do it, we can approach Council Member Allen to submit it when it comes time for the council to submit pieces.
I think that the Budget Support Act is the perfect vehicle. Having been on the council for 16 years, I can tell you it's a cleanup. It's an easy cleanup of something that has been problematic, ongoing problematic for like all the reasons that Bob, I thought, so articulately expressed, and you too, Jack. So I think that I think it's an easy sell as the Budget Support Act. I know you got the buy-in, you said, from the executive. I think you could easily get it from the council. I'd go to the chairman first and say, this is a, you know, priority for us, and it is just a cleanup. And, you know, it's not costing anybody anything. And, so that's the strategy. And then I agree that if for some crazy reason I can't imagine it not happening, and I would be glad to go over and sell it if you need me to stick it in and get it done, since it bothers nobody and actually rectifies ongoing problems of this group, of us, that I'd be glad to do that. And if for some strange reason it has to go a separate bill, I think going through the chair of the committee is perfect. But I don't think we should have to go that route, and I don't think we'll have to.
And we're meeting. We have a meeting set with Councilmember Allen next week, so we can tee this up for him.
So I have a meeting with him tomorrow. Do you not want me to mention
that? Oh, no, you can mention.
Okay.
Feel free.
And I have to say, just for the sake of full disclosure, I mentioned this to a couple of folks in the transparency community. I mentioned that I'm in a bit of a Hobson's choice position, just in terms of relinquishing the independent status of the office in an effort to get a more centralized budgeting process in place under BIGA. So the immediate reaction to this when I mentioned this was, well, we think that it's critically important for the office to retain its independent status. So I'm just informing the board that if this does fall under the Budget Support Act, we can anticipate testimony likely in opposition to the Office of Open Government no longer being an independent office. Additionally, I'm sure that there will be testimony that's going to be raised about the office needing to have, as it was originally intended, its to be entirely separate, period, its own budget. But I just wanted to let you all know that's some of the pushback that we can anticipate receiving.
Okay. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right.
The
only other thing is the comprehensive code.
Right.
Just in terms of process. So Mr. Grimaldi circulated the comprehensive code with the red lines, you know, some of the technical stuff and some cleanup stuff. And we have discussed on a couple of previous occasions now our determination to get this thing moving along. So we believe that it's ready to be submitted to Chairman Mendelson for to be moved. You know, we have the ability to propose legislation. We send it to him. He sends it forward. What we're proposing to do is let. And they know this already, so this is not a big mystery, is to let the committee know and let Councilmember Allen know that we intend to do it before the March legislative meeting. That is, we're going to send it up. And then if for some reason he or Councilmember McDuffie, who originally moved it, want to go ahead and do it before we send it to Chairman Mendelson, have at it. The goal is to get it introduced and started on its way. But if it's not done by the time we get to the, you know, the make or break moment, which is roughly March 1st, give or take?
I think March 3rd.
March
noon
3rd.
Of March 3rd to get it in for the legislative meeting on the 7th.
Right. So if, but that would be the goal. The goal would be to get, we're planning on introducing it. We're going to tell them we're going to introduce it. We're going to give them a copy of show, you know, they already have it, but give them the red line version. We've made our nits and changes here. And then if they want to do something, it's obviously up to them. But in the meantime, we've given everybody fair notice that we intend to put this thing back into play because it had been sitting for a year and a half and then lapsed. So if, everyone's comfortable with that approach, we'll go ahead and make sure that it happens. We should probably take a formal vote on this.
If any of the board members have questions, certainly, or want to propose some further revisions to the bill, I'd suggest you do it. You know, work on the red line and send them back to me.
Right.
But I don't know whether we need to take up time during this meeting today to do that.
All right.
Mr. Chairman,
yes, ma'am.
I just want to say, given the what Ms. Hughes just said, I still think the strategy is the best strategy, but I think also the independent nature of this position maybe could be handled like our appointments are handled, that you only can be dismissed. You have a certain appointment, and you're only dismissed for very strong, just cause. And I just throw that out as a way of addressing that.
Well, the other way to address it, too, is the fact that the board itself is independent. So to the extent that either of the two offices, their independence is questioned, I would say that having five board members who serve staggered terms and can't be dismissed is probably more independent than one director having a term. That's just my two cents.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay. Can I continue?
Please.
All right.
Sorry.
Rulemaking.
My job.
Thank you, Mr.
You turned over to Mr. Grimaldi, Mr. Silver.
I wrote that, by the way. Yeah.
Okay, there's two matters I just need your input on the rulemaking. The first is we want your approval on a rulemaking we're about to do on fines for confidential financial disclosure statement filings. During a recent enforcement action, an attorney for a respondent questioned our authority to impose fines on confidential filers who had filed but had not responded to all answers on the form. We have adopted a ministerial schedule of fines that includes, among the various offenses, failure to comply with all applicable financial disclosure statement filing requirements. This rulemaking clarifies and definitizes, is that your word, Mr. Flowers? Definitizes the fine that will be imposed on employees who fail to file a true, complete, and correct confidential report. Is that all the rulemaking does?
That's all this one does.
Okay. All right. And so we would ask you to approve that rulemaking for us so we can get it out there, at least for notice and comment. We're not planning on doing it as an emergency, but we're going to at least get it out there.
I mean, that makes sense. I mean, we have a schedule of fines. People should know that applies to incomplete answers as well.
Right. Okay. So maybe we'll take a vote on that since it is an official action of the board.
Sure.
Okay.
So there's a motion to adopt a rule change that will clarify what it means to fail to meet the requirements of the applicable financial disclosure statement filing requirements, and makes clear what the fine is going to be for folks who do not file a true, complete, and correct confidential report. So that's before us. I guess we'll get who's going to move to approve it, but we'll move to go ahead and approve it. anybody want to discuss the issue? No? All those in favor of the request?
Aye.
No opposed? Go ahead, Mr. Sobel.
Great, thank you. So approved, we will go ahead with publication and look for a notice and comment. Or look for comments. Item two, the existing rules, this is on appeal rules for informal admonitions that I issue. So as you all may know, one of my prerogatives as a director is where there are certain extremely low-level offenses, technical violations of a rule or other conditions that are something less than what we would normally want to bring an enforcement action on that would become public, I have the ability to sort of issue this, it's more or less a warning letter. It's called an informal admonition. It says, you know, sort of tisk tisk, you know, you did this, don't do it again. But with that, and I don't have to go through you guys to do it. And I do it from time to time. There is existing now a process by which somebody receives one of my informal admonitions, never becomes public, but they don't like it and they disagree with me. And so there's currently a path by asking me to reconsider. And then when I don't reconsider, or if I reconsider and say, no, I'm not reconsidering, they can go to you guys on appeal. Right now, there is no direct appeal. So they have to go through the reconsideration process first. We think that this should be more like sort of a superior court of appeals process whereby they can either do a direct appeal or go through reconsideration. And so we'd like to adopt, not today, but we'd like to formulate some rules that would capture that. And if anybody else has any, you know, input as to whether or not a better process would work, I'd be happy to hear it.
No, I mean, that makes sense to me. It should be consistent.
Okay. Right. And we would be putting a 15-day appeal date on it because right now there is no time. There's no set time. So years from now, the guy can come back and file an appeal and no one will be.
There should be a time frame.
Okay.
That makes sense.
Mr. Raldi, any?
The only one thing I wanted to add is that the Ethics Act does provide for appeals to the board from informal non-public admonitions. But as Mr. Sobin just explained in detail, the regs don't pick that up.
Right. Okay, so we'll formulate that and get it to you for next month's meeting.
Great. Thank you.
Item G on the budget. Our budget request is under consideration by the Mayor's Budget Office. As I told you last month, a meeting had been scheduled on our request for budget enhancement for fiscal year 18. We did, in fact, meet with the Mayor's budget folks and made our best pitch for our budget enhancement, which is needed to cover both non-personal service expenditures, such as overhead and board member stipends. I know an issue of interest to all of you. As well as personal service costs, which we hope this year will include an additional administrative employee to assist with lobbyists and FDS matters. Importantly, we have also asked for close to $1 million over 5 years as part of our capital budget plan to overhaul and maintain our FDS lobbyist e-filing system, which will not only fix a myriad of ongoing technical and usability problems, but will keep us in compliance with cybersecurity measures imposed by the Office of the Chief Financial Officer on us. As it happens, last week, the Council passed legislation entitled the Council Financial Disclosure Amendment Act of 2016. The statute, which we believe is now law, will require council members to file public financial disclosure statements with BEGA twice per year, May 15th and November 15th, instead of once a year as they do currently.
Yeah.
This act will apply upon the date of inclusion of its fiscal impact in an approved budget and financial plan, which means it's not actually applicable yet until that event occurs. The fiscal impact is estimated by the OCFO, as I said earlier, to be $94,000 for fiscal year 2017. Those are initially the startup costs. I guess they're trying to figure out what it would take for our e-filing system to be modified to accept an extra set of filings, an additional time each year, and then $45,000 for fiscal year 18 and thereafter. The bulk of this cost is to modify, again, the e-filing system. I notified the mayor's budget team of this, and it is being factored into our enhancement request. So that's good. That's good because they understand it's not just a pie-in-the-sky thing. It's actually would be holding up the implementation of a new law. Our oversight hearing is scheduled for February 23rd. As Director Hughes said, we are preparing our answers to the committee chair's written questions, which will be submitted next week. We are also preparing testimony, which will be delivered by the chairman for us, for BEGA. I understand, Director Hughes, you're going to do separate testimony?
I'm going to be testifying on behalf of the Office of Open Government.
Right. Okay. From everything I've seen so far, we should be in excellent shape for the hearing as far as oversight and performance measures. Very productive year last year. Item H, staffing. Last month, I was very pleased to introduce to you our new temporary attorney, Ms. Asia Stewart. This month, I am saddened to report that we will be losing one of our permanent attorney advisors, Mr. Rudy Shanoon, who will be taking a position with Fire and Emergency Medical Services as an assistant general counsel. We will miss Rudy very much, but wish him well in his new role for the district government.
Well, Mr. Shanoon. So Dwayne got you, didn't he? That's what happened. That's what happened. Well, at least we get to keep you in the government. That's the important thing.
I did some poaching when we set up this office, and now it's been done to me. All's fair.
Karma wheel has spun around.
In the meantime, we expect both of our FMLA employees, Ms. Dillon and Ms. Cooks, to return to work in the next month. Ms. Dillon graciously has been working part-time during her FMLA leave period already, but it will be great to have her back full-time as we ramp up for FDS filing season. And speaking of FDS filing season, on item I, number one, we are preparing this year in a number of ways for filing. First, we created an updated the financial disclosure form. I'm sorry, we created an updated financial disclosure form by removing the question regarding spousal income and made modifications to the form to make the questions more in line with the statute. A demo of this updated form was uploaded to an e-filing test site earlier this week. We will run several tests on this new form and will make additional modifications if needed. Again, if you remember, this was the issue that was brought to our attention by the General Counsel of the Council last year,
right,
and we've now made that fix. Second, we have scheduled the financial disclosure season kickoff meeting with all of our ethics counselors next Wednesday, February 15th, in this hearing room. During the meeting, we will review the financial disclosure filing process, including what criteria agencies should use in determining whether it should designate an employee as a filer. We'll also go over the differences between public and confidential filers, and we will cover the reporting deadlines for agencies to submit their list of filers to this office. This is mandatory, but a makeup meeting has also been scheduled for the following day. Third, we are preparing a step-by-step reference guide for agency heads and ethics counselors to use when determining what employees are required to file their financial disclosure statements. This has been an ongoing issue the last few years. Our statute, when it was designed to be a one-stop shop for financial disclosure filing, created even more confusion, it seems, because people were so used to filing two separate forms each year, depending on where you were in the government. And so our educational efforts continue, hence the reason for the mandatory training. And we think that this is going to really, along with this step-by-step reference guide, help agency heads when they're trying to figure out who has to file what and with whom. Finally, in an additional effort to encourage agency compliance, we have informed all agencies that if they comply with the financial disclosure deadlines, they will receive a, quote, certificate of excellence from the office and will be recognized on our website. This is sort of the carrot to the stick approach, which will come later when the noncompliant agencies will be also listed on the website in a much different light. Excuse me. Item two, confidential disclosure statement enforcement and audit of the 2016 confidential disclosure statement review reports revealed that approximately 180 employees who were designated as confidential filers failed to submit their CFDS forms to their agency head by May 16, 2016 deadline. That is juxtaposed to our near 100% compliance rate for our responsibilities on the public filer side. So it was quite a number. On February 3rd, we sent out a mass email to all of these noncompliant filers instructing them to immediately file their CFDS with their agency. We received a number of responses and will be following up in the coming weeks with personalized correspondence to any remaining noncompliant employees. Again, this has been a resource-driven obligation that we just haven't had the resources to do.
Right.
And that's the but we felt it was critical to get it, to get this done before the next cycle of FDS filers, begins in, next month. So we're going to be working hard on that. Triple I, item triple I, status of appeals. We did have a couple of district employees, Edwin Adakwe and Charlene Dickens, two DDOT employees who filed appeals in Superior Court regarding the board's denial of their request for a waiver from filing their financial disclosure statements. They had their first court date on January 27th. Mr. Adakwe's next court date, a status hearing, is April 28th, 2017, and Ms. Dickens is in August 2017, and the Attorney General's office is representing us in those cases. Okay, any questions before we move on to lobbying?
Nope. All right.
We just finished a very busy January lobbyist filing season, which included this office's attorney staff responding to numerous inquiries and conducting an aggressive outreach effort to ensure greater compliance. As you are aware, lobbyist registrations for the 2017 calendar year were due January 15th, and activity reports covering the second half of 2016 were due January 10th. To date, 275 registration forms have been filed for 2017. In addition, approximately 371 January 2017 activity reports were filed, and 71 termination reports were filed. Hmm. A breakdown of these filings is summarized as follows. Late filed lobbyist report and or termination reports were 25. Total amount of late filers who paid fines or the amount collected was 24, and which was translated to over $1,000. Total amount of remaining late filers who did have, who did not, who did have, who have not paid their fines was 2. Or $30. That's pretty good. That's not a lot outstanding. There are currently 3 registered lobbyists who have not filed their January 2017 lobbyist activity report at all. We've reached out to all 3 via phone calls, mailings, and emails regarding their reporting requirements, and we anticipate that at least one of these will file their activity reports in the near future. This year, the office will publish on its website a list of all non-compliant lobbyists, including those who filed their lobbyist reports but did not pay fines that were assessed, and those lobbyists who did not file their reports at all. We have informed the 9 filers. We've informed the non-compliant filers of the new procedure and anticipate publishing the list on February 15th. Again, we sort of the stick approach to our carrot. We do have 2 waiver requests, neither of which we are opposing. 1587-001, Children's National Health System, and 1595-001, Greater Washington Board of Trade. I'm going to turn this over to Ms. Foster.
Okay, good morning. The first waiver request, which is Children's National Health System. In that case, Children's is requesting a waiver of a $300 fine from the July 2016 lobbyist activity report. We're not opposing their request. In this case, the person that handled their lobbying filing left and apparently didn't inform the staff that she had been handling it, so all of our notifications were getting sent to someone who no longer worked there, so they weren't receiving notice of all of the filing deadlines. In the second instance, that's the Greater Washington Board of Trade waiver request. They're requesting a waiver of the fine from January 2017. In this case, what we discovered was that for whatever reason, their password into the e-filing system had been disabled. It was the same password, but we discovered there had been some kind of glitch with our vendor that actually runs the e-filing site. So they had attempted to log in and weren't able to. And instead of fixing that issue, our office unfortunately gave them a new login altogether, which didn't revert back to their original registration. So in recognition of all of that, we took the position that we wouldn't be opposing their waiver request.
Okay. Well, I think both are reasonable, and in light of your agreement that the fines be waived, I would go ahead and vote to waive the fines in both cases.
I agree.
I'll go ahead. I have the orders here, so I'll go ahead and sign them. All right. You go ahead, Mr. Sova.
Okay, item J, the non-confidential investigations. We have only one update to give you this month. Mr. Jaron Price. The Court of Appeals issued an order for Mr. Price to show cause as to why his petition for review should not be dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. The Court of Appeals has not yet ruled on this issue, and no court dates have been set. By way of background, the Ethics Act provides that appeals of any order or fine made by the Ethics Board shall be made to the Superior Court. However, the District of Columbia Administrative Procedure Act provides that the Court of Appeals has exclusive jurisdiction to hear appeals of contested cases, which potentially would cover Mr. Price's hearing before the board. We are in communication with the Office of the Solicitor General of the Attorney General's Office regarding the status of this matter, and will continue to update the board as it moves through the appeals process.
Well, poor Mr. Price, caught in legal limbo there between the Superior Court and Court of Appeals. I would just note for the record that the CCC fixes this problem. So
this is a problem that should have been fixed long ago.
A long time ago.
Because essentially it denies anybody the right to appeal.
Neither Superior Court won't hear it, and the Court of Appeals, they may hear it, but they haven't gotten there quite yet. But it'll get resolved either by the Court of Appeals or by the council.
Okay, and that's it for the public portion of the meeting.
Okay, great. So now at this point, we generally make available some time for our members of the public to address the board. I know that we have someone who wants to be dialed. Mr. Sindrum wants to dial in. So let's go ahead and do that. I see only the usual suspects here. So other than Mr. Sindrum, I think that will be it.
Hi, Mr. Sindrum. This is Tracy Hughes.
Hello?
Mr. Sindrum?
Speaking.
Hi, this is Tracy Hughes. So we are now in the public portion of our monthly meeting. You're on the speakerphone.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Good afternoon, Mr. Sindrum.
And other members. I wanted to give a shout-out, if you will, to Ms. Yu. She's been very instrumental and helpful navigating some of the things that have been going on, so I wanted to give praise where praise is due.
Duly noted.
Last we met, I was directed, well, back up a minute, had a chat offline with Thomas Cook, who stated, "I don't like you." And then he had the audacity to question my military record. I don't know where he's coming from or what he thinks he is, but all that to say that that's muddied, you know, what business I need to take care of. So I was then directed to go upstairs to talk with a fellow investigator to get the matter on track. Instead of that happening, I was told to connect with Brian Flowers, left my name and number, and I haven't heard a word. The problem and issue there is there's a disconnect. Mr. Flowers, in an earlier life, was a general counsel for the council, and therein lies the rift. And I would suggest that there be outside independent counsel appointed, because I'm going nowhere quick. So I'm going to defer to your wisdom and the board's wisdom on how to deal with this.
Well, I mean, I'll turn to Mr. Sobin, but I think that the staff of the Office of Government Ethics stands ready, willing, and able to speak with you about whatever complaint you may be raising. Mr. Sobin?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably just a miscommunication or a misunderstanding. We are ready to and willing and able to listen and speak with him. We have another investigator, although I believe that all of our investigators are highly skilled and highly qualified and professional and courteous, but we do have another investigator. Mr. Sindrum would like to speak to her. She is available.
Very good. So what I would ask is that you all are, I mean, we're not going to do this in the public portion of the meeting, obviously, but arrange a time certain, perhaps. That way there'll be no miscommunication about who's calling who and at what time. And then you can move forward with whatever matter you want to bring to their attention.
Okay. I would just, Mr. Sindrum can call the main line and ask to schedule an appointment with Ms. Or I should say Investigator Corrales, and then we'll take it from there.
Great. Can you give him the main number while we're on the phone?
It's 202-481-3411.
And that's precisely who I spoke with last month, Investigator Corrales, who then deferred my query to Mr. Flowers. And I did leave my contact information, but I haven't heard. So, you know, round and round we go. And I want to nip this in the bud and not keep getting stonewalled.
Okay. Well, I think all you need to do is Ms. Corrales is here in the room. She's listening to this whole thing, and I'm sure she'll be happy to speak with you. So if you want to go ahead and set up an appointment and a time to speak, whether it's by phone or in person, I would encourage you to do so.
Well, we can do that now?
Well, we're in the public portion of the meeting, Mr. Sobin just gave you the main number. We can give it to you again if you'd like.
202-481-3411.
Okay. And all right. Very well.
Thank you, Mr. Sindrum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have a good and godly day.
You do the same.
Yes, sir.
Bye now. So at this point, we'll be moving to a closed executive non-public session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Code 2-575B to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Code 2-575B13 and personal matters pursuant to DC Code 2-575B10. If I could get a motion to go to that session, I would appreciate it. Moved and seconded. All those in favor? Aye. No one opposed? Okay, so the time is now 12:12, and we're going to go off the public record and then come right back on the closed. Okay, so we're back on the public record. It's 12:43, and we only have two things. One thing, really, to report out from the closed session. That is, there are two audits that were conducted that the board has reviewed and signed off on, both of which will be posted on the website following the meeting. Anything else?
Nothing from me.
And then our next meeting is March 9th, 1 month from today. Everyone have a great month. We'll see you
Thank
then.
Thank you guys very much.
Oh, and don't forget, February 23rd is our oversight hearing. I'll be there.
All right.